Star Walker Studios presents Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. Hello, fellow gamer. Welcome to episode 152 of Game Master's Journey, your multidimensional RPG podcast. I'm Lex Starwalker. On this show, we discuss the craft and art of game mastering. Not only do I pass along any knowledge I've gained over 25 plus years of running RPGs, I also share wisdom from guest GMs and listener GMs like you. Today, I begin discussing Chapter 1 of the DMG, A World of Your Own. We'll discuss the core assumptions of the published D&D settings and how you can alter them to create a world that's truly unique. I'll also discuss my homebrew world of Primordia and how I've approached these core assumptions. Finally, I'll talk a bit about my continuing journey in designing the gods, pantheons, portfolios, and domains of Primordia. Join me on the journey. Together, we can become game masters truly worthy of the title. Hello, listener. Welcome back to the show. So great to be coming back at you again with some more RPG discussion. I just want to let you know that I have started running the Hidden Shrine of Tomawakan on my YouTube channel. We live stream the game every Monday from 6 until 9-ish p.m. Pacific time, and the videos are available afterwards for posterity on the YouTube channel. So if you can come watch while we're streaming, that's awesome. You can say hi in the chat channel. Otherwise, you can just watch anytime that's convenient for you on the YouTube channel. We played our first session last week, and we're playing our second session this week. So by the time I get this produced and it's playing in your ear holes, the second session should be up. But you can tune in for our third session next week on Monday. Also want to remind you that my D&D adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth, is now available on the website over at starwalkerstudios.com/tricky. Hope you'll check it out. It's a great adventure for a standalone adventure, or you could easily drop it into an ongoing campaign. Works great as a segue adventure if you need a way to get the PCs from one place to another, whether that's, you know, one place in the world to another, or from one world to another, or one plane to another. Works great for all those things. It's a level for third level characters, so if you want to run it as a one-off, or if you want to use it to kick off a new campaign, I do have thoughts in there on how to create new third level characters, and I hope you check it out. My wife Nikki and I worked hard on it, and hope you enjoy it. So as I said, today I am going to be discussing the DMG and also discussing world building, and we've got a lot to cover today. So without further ado, let's move on to our discussion of the DMG. Today, I thought we would try to kill two birds with one stone. I want to attempt at the same time to continue our discussion of the Dungeon Master's Guide for D&D 5th Edition, and also to start talking about world building again and start to give an introduction to my D&D homebrew world of Primordia. I've done over 20 some episodes on world building on the show in the past, and I started at the very beginning with just very basic concepts and ideas and thoughts about a world I wanted to create, and I've taken you with me through that journey thus far. But I thought it might be nice for newer listeners of the show who maybe don't have the time to get completely caught up on all the previous episodes to do a new introduction to the setting as it stands right now. There's been at least two or three pretty substantial revisions to Primordia since I first started designing it, and probably would help us all to kind of be on the same page. And so we're all clear on where things stand right now, and we're not getting confused about the different versions and what's the newest version? What did we finally decide? So this next part of the Dungeon Master's Guide, part one, actually, in a previous episode, we discussed the introduction and really spent the majority of that discussion on page six, Know Your Players, and talking about the different aspects of the game that players might enjoy and how you can kind of bring out those aspects for players that enjoy that. So today we're getting ready to get into part one and get into chapter one. And part one of the Dungeon Master's Guide is called Master of Worlds. And this part of the book is all about creating your own setting, creating your own campaign, creating your own settlements, creating NPCs, things like that. And so I think a great way to kind of approach this is to kind of dovetail it in with our world building discussion. Because here in chapter one, which is called A World of Your Own, we start talking about just very high level elements of your world, beginning with the core assumptions of what exactly is this world like. And we're going to talk about this in a minute, kind of the core assumptions that your standard D&D setting makes, and then how some of the published settings deviate from those core assumptions. And then I thought I would also talk about my thoughts in regards to Primordia on these topics. And hopefully all of this will be a great context for you if you want to start building your own world, to start having these thoughts about a world of your own, which ironically is the title of the first chapter, A World of Your Own. So that's what we're doing, or at least that's what I'm going to attempt. And hopefully we can have a nice discussion on this without it getting super long and without getting really bogged down in details and stuff. And kind of for today, keep this kind of high-level view, these broad strokes of your setting to start out with. So this chapter, chapter one of the DMG, starts out by saying, your world is a setting for your campaign, the place where adventures happen. Even if you use an existing setting, such as the Forgotten Realms, of course we have to mention the Forgotten Realms, or they do, we don't, but they do, it becomes yours as you set your adventures there, create characters to inhabit it, and make changes to it over the course of your campaign. This chapter is all about building your world and then creating a campaign to take place in it. And this is actually a really good point that's made here in this first paragraph. Even if you are running in someone else's settings, whether that's the Forgotten Realms or Eberron or some other setting, you still get to do world building. You still get to make that setting your own. You don't have to be a slave to the quote canon of the setting. And this is especially an issue, I think, with Forgotten Realms, maybe more than any other setting, if only because it is kind of Wizards of the Coast pet setting right now. And you've got, you know, their adventures that they're putting out every year that are having things happen in the realms. You've got the Neverwinter MMO, which has things happening in the realms. So it can be really easy if you're a DM running in the realms or some other published setting to fall into this trap of a mindset where you think that you have to care about all that stuff and that you have to be true to it. And the truth is that you don't. As soon as you decide, I'm running a campaign, this is the setting I'm using, that setting becomes yours. And you should really, I think, take a moment to kind of sit with that, you know, kind of internalize that and tell yourself, hey, for example, the Forgotten Realms is now mine. This is my version of the realms, and I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm going to feel free to change things. I'm going to feel free to add things, take things out, do whatever I want to do whatever I need to do to make this setting what I need it to be, to make it fun for my games, for the stories I want to tell, and for my players who are going to play in this setting with me. So I think it's important that the authors of this book make this point and are kind of giving you permission to use their settings or anyone's settings however you want in your game. And even as a homebrewer, you can do this as well. So I am building my own world of Primordia, and I'm not afraid to take something from the Forgotten Realms or Eberron or some other setting that I like and just put it in the Primordia. Why the hell not? And really, I think it's a great idea to do that when you can, because, for instance, let's say I wanted to put the city of Waterdeep in Primordia. Maybe I'd call it something else. Maybe I wouldn't. Maybe I'd just call it Waterdeep. There are literally books of information out there on Waterdeep that I could use as source material to flesh out my Waterdeep or whatever I decided to call it and save myself a lot of time. And instead of having to come up with all that stuff and reinvent the wheel, I can come up with additional stuff or decide how I'm going to change things or whatever. So, you know, I think whether you're running in a published world or you're creating your own world, I think that you should feel free to steal ideas from any published settings that you want, even from other games, and use those. And I don't think you should feel guilty about it. I don't think you should worry about it. And again, if you are using a published setting, I think you should feel like you have free rein to do whatever the hell you want with that setting, because you do. And the more you make that setting your own, the more fun you're going to have with it, the more free you're going to feel to make decisions on the fly and not feel like you have to go look things up, because you're not worried about the canon and keeping true to that, because you've made the world your own and now you're establishing your own canon. And, you know, when Wizards comes out with a new adventure or a new storyline, you can decide whether or not to use that in your version of the world and how much and how to do so. So next we have the big picture. So this is when we're really going to start talking about specific ideas when it comes to building your own world. This book, The Player's Handbook and The Monster Manual, present the default assumptions for how the worlds of D&D work. Among the established settings of D&D, the Forgotten Realms, Greyhawk, Dragonlance, and Mystara don't stray very far from these assumptions. Settings such as Darksun, Eberron, Ravenloft, Spelljammer, and Planescape venture further away from that baseline. As you create your own world, it's up to you to decide where on the spectrum you want your world to fall. All right, so at this point, I'm going to go a little out of order of what's in the book here. We're on page 9 of the DMG. We're in the very beginning. We start out with some core assumptions, and it discusses each of these core assumptions. And again, these are core assumptions that tend to hold true in your more vanilla or generic D&D worlds like Greyhawk, Dragonlance, Forgotten Realms, Mystara. And then after that, we have a section called It's Your World, where they revisit some of these assumptions and ask questions about, well, what would the world look like if we made different assumptions? And I think that's a fine way to do it. But for the sake of our discussion today, I'm going to organize this a little bit differently, and I'm going to kind of jump around between these two sections, and I'm going to hit a core assumption, and then we're going to discuss the different variations on that core assumption and then go to the next core assumption. I think just in the podcast format, that's a better way to approach it than the way they have it organized here. So if you're following along in your book, I'm going to be jumping back and forth between the core assumption section and the It's Your World section. And also, as we do this, I will talk some about my thoughts about Primordia. And I don't think I mentioned this episode, but one of the reasons I wanted to do it this way and I wanted to kind of combine one of these DMG episodes with a world building episode is, first of all, I mean, obviously this is about world building. But the other reason is because it's actually reading these sections in the Dungeon Master's Guide that really got me inspired to make my own world. And the way that they kind of organized this process and presented it in these kind of bite-sized little pieces made what can often seem an insurmountable task, creating an entire world, it made it seem much more accessible and approachable and doable. And I started getting really excited about coming up with something myself. And it was really this core assumptions section where that really started, just thinking about, what are some ways that I could play with these core assumptions and maybe keep some of them and change some of them and come up with something that at the same time seems like a D&D world, but also seems in some ways different than any D&D world you've seen before. And so hopefully you'll find this inspiring as well, and you'll get to a point where you just have to pause this podcast and start taking notes on your world that's germinating in your mind, or at least some ideas on it. And that's awesome. I just hope you come back to me after you're done with that and continue on. All right. So again, these are core assumptions that are made in a lot of these kind of more standard D&D worlds, and also some ways that you could deviate from those assumptions. So the first assumption here is gods oversee the world. The gods are real and embody a variety of beliefs, with each god claiming dominion over an aspect of the world, such as war, forests, or the sea. Gods exert influence over the world by granting divine magic to their followers and sending signs and portents to guide them. The follower of a god serves as an agent of that god in the world. The agent seeks to further the ideals of that god and defeat its rivals. While some folk might refuse to honor the gods, none can deny their existence. So that's kind of a core assumption in a lot of D&D worlds, is this idea of the gods are real, the gods are present in the world, they are forces to be reckoned with, they are forces to be reckoned with, they have agents in the world, among them clerics and paladin player characters, and these agents further these gods' agendas. So here are a couple ways that we could take that core assumption and change it, make a different assumption when it comes to the gods. So it says gods inhabit the land or are entirely absent. What if the gods regularly walk the earth? What if the characters can challenge them and seize their power? Or what if the gods are remote and even angels never make contact with mortals? In the Dark Sun setting, the gods are extremely distant, perhaps non-existent, and clerics rely instead on elemental power for their magic. So those are two different ways that you could take this core assumption of gods being present in the world and change it. And you're kind of twisting that dial one way or the other. You're either saying that gods are even more present by saying that they're actually living in the world. So maybe instead of living on an outer plane somewhere, your gods actually live in the world on like something like Mount Olympus or something. Or turning that dial down the other way and saying that the gods are absent. Maybe they're all dead, or maybe they're just these distant, unknowable cosmic forces that don't really have any concern for what's going on in the prime material world. So those are two examples of where you could go, and those are kind of representing sort of extremes on either end of this assumption of the gods being part of the world, and you could go even more extreme on either of those ends, or you could go somewhere in between. So this is something personally with my world of Primordia that I've gone round and round about. And this is probably one of the things that I've changed the most and the most often in developing my world. If not, it probably is the one thing that I have changed the most and the most often. I remember when I first read this section about, you know, gods inhabiting the land are entirely absent. I kind of liked both of them, actually. I liked the idea of the gods being actual physical beings that you might encounter without having to travel through different planes, that you could just go to a hidden glade in a forest somewhere and encounter a god, or find an island somewhere and encounter a god, or in a volcano or something. You know, very similar to, I've always been a huge fan of the Iliad and the Odyssey, and how Odysseus in his journeys trying to get home from the Trojan War, how he encountered more than one god in kind of strange places. And he didn't have to leave the world to do so. He'd just be in some hidden, you know, secret place in the world, and he'd come up against a god. And I think that's really cool. And, you know, it'd be kind of fun to play in a world where that's a possibility. On the other hand, I also really like this idea of the gods being mysterious and being beyond mortal comprehension. And this idea that even the clerics and the paladins and the various religious figures in the world really don't know a god's mind. They're making their best guess, and they may be close or they may be completely off in left field. And, you know, the truth is they don't know which that is or which of those is true. If I could talk straight, you know, they don't know. They're just, you know, making their best guess because the gods have better things to do than explain things to their mortal followers. So I liked elements of both of those. And I think as I look back on what I've done with the gods in my world, I think I've always been trying to pull in those elements that I like from both of those extremes at the same time. So I find myself wondering if I should go down this rabbit hole right now, because I've actually been thinking about my gods quite a lot lately. And I think I will. I think I will go down the rabbit hole. This might mean that we don't get through all the core assumptions today, but that's okay. We're just going to follow this where it takes us. So as I said, the gods have changed a lot since I first read this section and I first started thinking about what the gods in my world would be like. And I've done numerous, actually, episodes about the gods in my world. And just to give you kind of the quick recap, if I can remember accurately, I believe I started out, one of my thoughts from the very beginning, and I still share this thought to a large degree, was I did not want to have as many gods as you see in, for instance, the Forgotten Realms, where there are pantheons upon pantheons. Every intelligent race has their own pantheons. Even a lot of the monsters, like the goblins and the orcs and et cetera, have their own pantheons. And it's just dozens upon dozens, if not hundreds. I don't know how many gods there really are in the Forgotten Realms. I would not be surprised if there are over 100, but a lot, right? And way more than most people could or would want to deal with, to the point that your average player isn't going to be able to rattle off all the gods and tell you something about all of them. So right away, I thought, I want to have a smaller number of gods than that. I want to have a manageable number so that players can actually learn who the gods are. Because realistically, in a city like Alandria, in a polytheistic culture, most people would know who the gods are. They would know all the gods. You know, your average character in one of these worlds would know who all the gods are, at least the gods that are worshipped in their area. You know, they wouldn't, like if this was Forgotten Realms, they wouldn't know every god in every pantheon, but they would know all the gods in their pantheon, whichever one they worshipped. And they would know, you know, the basic things about each of those gods. So in a way, it's kind of out of character for the players not to know that, or at least for their characters not to know that. And it's definitely more satisfying, I think, for everyone at the table if the players can have that knowledge, or at least a good portion of that knowledge, instead of the DM always having to info dump what their characters know about various gods. It'd be nice if, say, there are, just to pick a number, 9 gods that are worshipped in this area. It'd be nice if the players knew, you know, could tell you what the 9 gods are and could tell you, you know, in a sentence what each god represents. You know, not everything about the god, not their favorite color and, you know, what the armor their clerics wear looks like or things like that necessarily, but just the gist. Kind of like, I'll bet a lot of us listening to the show right now, I know I could probably rattle off quite a few of the Greek gods and could tell you a little bit about what Athena and Ares and Hades and Artemis and Demeter and Dionysus, what they represented, what they were about, right? I mean, I could probably name off all of the, you know, the most common ones right now and tell you basically what their portfolio would be, or at least some elements of it, right? So it's a doable thing. And, you know, it's something, you know, if you're exposed to something a lot, you just kind of absorb it. It's not like players have to do homework or anything. But I do think that the smaller the number of total gods is, the easier that is, right? So I definitely wanted to avoid having an elven pantheon and a dwarven pantheon and a halfling pantheon and a gnome pantheon and a human pantheon and blah, 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 blah. I wanted to avoid that. So one idea I had in the very beginning that I've pretty much been sticking with all throughout is one pantheon of gods. There's going to be one pantheon of gods that everybody worships. I'm not going to have different pantheons for every race, if only because, A, I don't want to have to create all those gods. I mean, it's bad enough having to create 20 gods, but then having to create 20 gods for every single race? No, thank you. And B, you know, I want it to be manageable for the players so that the players can feel like they know about the world without having to sink a bunch of time and effort into learning pantheons. So the way I started out was I actually started out with Forgotten Realms gods because when I first started playing D&D, I ran in Dragonlance in Kryn, but I think within a year after when I started running D&D, I started running in Forgotten Realms just because the Dritz books were really big back then. What were those computer games? The Eye of the Beholder games were around then, I believe. So even way back then, I mean, the realms were kind of you could have gotten in arguments back then about whether the realms or Dragonlance were more popular, but it seemed like the realms were more popular and more like people that I would pull into my games tended to know something about the realms, where maybe not so much Dragonlance. And I was reading the Dritz books and really digging them. So I thought, hey, I'll just, you know, start running in the realms. And so for a long time, up through 3.5, I ran in the realms. It's only here recently in 5th edition that I've started creating my own world and not running in the realms anymore. So I'm fairly familiar with the Forgotten Realms gods. Specifically, I'm pretty familiar with the human gods. I'm very familiar with the elven gods because I tend to play elven characters a lot. And as a DM, I tended to come up with a lot of my storylines had to do with things that were going on with the elves. So I knew the elven pantheons, including the drow elf pantheons, really well. Knew the dwarf dwarf pantheon fairly well, at least the most popular dwarven deities. So I started there. I started, I think, with the elven gods. I picked all the elven gods I really liked, and then I filled in gaps with dwarven gods and human gods, and I kind of took my favorite gods from Forgotten Realms and made this big-ass pantheon that was mainly elven gods with a few dwarven gods, a few human gods, and I think I had like Tiamat in there and Grumsh and some other of the kind of monster gods that I thought were really cool. And that's how I started out. And I'm trying to remember exactly why I moved away from that. I think part of it was just trying to, they have this problem where I want to explain everything. It's not just enough for me to say, hey, I grabbed these random assortments of gods from the Forgotten Realms just because these are the gods I like, and these are the gods in Primordia, and that's the end of it, which I could have totally done and probably should have. No, that's not enough for me. I wanted it to actually make sense. I wanted to have a conceptual reason why these gods are here and other gods aren't. And I came up with this idea of it was mainly a world that was overseen by the elven gods, and then some other gods were able to come in over time, but it was primarily elven gods. But more and more, I kind of wanted to come up with my own gods, because a lot of those gods are so steeped in Forgotten Realms, and I didn't want Primordia to just feel like a different version of Forgotten Realms. I wanted it to feel like its own place. And the other thing was when I started trying to map out domains and realizing, you know, at that point in the game, we only had 8 domains, and realizing that, okay, there are 8 domains, but like, for instance, the Forgotten Realms, there's dozens of gods. And even with the 20 or some that I had that I'd kind of narrowed down that I was going to use in Primordia, you know, I had a lot of gods sharing the same domains. And I started a discussion recently on the Game Master's Journey community about domains, and I was trying to get people to brainstorm ideas for new domains. And we had a few ideas presented, but unfortunately the conversation seems to have gotten derailed into talking more about what are domains and what do they mean and what's the point of domains. And it's kind of interesting because I just had this assumption all this time that I knew what a domain was. And I think in third edition, at least I did. And in Pathfinder, I did. But I think in fifth edition, I think the concept of even what a domain is has changed. And I sometimes wonder if there even is a concept of what a domain is in fifth edition, other than just a mechanical thing. Just a mechanical little trick to give clerics something like the wizard schools of magic, to give clerics archetypes and to give different clerics access to different, quote, non-cleric spells. And honestly, I think, and I'm afraid that in the minds of the designers of the game, that that's really what a domain is. It's just a way to give a cleric access to different non-cleric spells. And we've come up with these 8, now 9, not counting Unearthed Arcana stuff, domains that divide up those different kinds of non-cleric spells fairly evenly. So mechanically, sure, great idea, works great and everything. But unfortunately, at least for me, conceptually, it's not internally consistent. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So, you know, in third edition, at least, to me, a domain was a representation of a god's portfolio. You know, so you might have a god who is the god of war and the god of lightning, for instance. And so that god might have access to a war domain and a lightning domain. And then a cleric of that god could choose, do I want to be a war cleric of this god? Or do I want to be a lightning cleric of this god? And I think it was in Pathfinder where they had the idea, which I thought was kind of a cool idea, where every god had like two domains, and there was an actual in-world difference between the clerics of those two domains. Like they're almost like two different factions within the religion. So in my example of this war lightning god, you know, there'd be the faction of the war domain clerics and then a faction of the lightning domain clerics. They both worship the same god, but they have slightly different beliefs. They have slightly different agendas, slightly different ways of approaching things. And they might even at times be in conflict with one another. I thought that was really cool. That kind of cohesion, that kind of synergy between the mechanics of what a domain is and the story or in-world realities of what a domain is, I feel like are gone in fifth edition. I feel like we've lost that. And you know, it's even further muddied by things like, well, anybody can be a life cleric. So this is a rule in the PHB. If you make a cleric, it doesn't matter what your deity is, you can be a life cleric. So you could be a cleric of the god of death and have the life domain, because any cleric can have the life domain. Why? Is it because that makes sense from any kind of in-world or story or conceptual perspective? No, obviously not. The reason has nothing to do with story or concept or anything with that. It just has to do with mechanics and game balance and the idea, I would say the incorrect idea that a cleric should at least have the option to be a really good healer. So any player character cleric can be a life cleric because they're the best healers. And we want a group to be able to have a life cleric in the party for mechanical game balance reasons, but we don't want to force that player to have to choose a specific god that has the life domain. So we're just going to make this rule that, oh, well, it doesn't matter. As far as life domain, you can worship any god. Now, all the other domains, you have to worship a god that has that domain. So I think just through that example, you can see how, you know, in a in-world, in-fiction sense, there's no validity to it. It doesn't make any sense at all. And sure, you could jump through hoops trying to come up with some kind of explanation, but it's pretty clear that the real reason has to do with gameplay. It has nothing to do with in-character stuff. So it's kind of on the DM and on the players to try to make some sense of that if they can. So try to make sense of why your war cleric has the life domain, or your cleric of a war deity, or why your cleric of the god of murder has the life domain. You can try to figure that out for yourselves, I guess. So like I said, I was approaching this from this perspective of domains having an in-world meaning and something that characters would be aware of in the world and that makes sense and that relate or correlate to the deity's portfolio. So in like third edition and Pathfinder, deities often had access to more than one domain, and it tended to correspond with how big that deity's portfolio was. So for instance, the elven god Corlan, I mean, his portfolio is just basically he's the god of everything. I mean, everything from magic to combat to art to, I mean, just anything elves might be into, Corlan is the god of, it seems like. And so if I remember right, he had quite a few domains that he had access to, which kind of made sense because he had such a broad portfolio. And another thing that was different in third edition in Pathfinder is there is a lot more domains than we have in fifth edition. And it did seem like they were trying to make domains to represent portfolio aspects. So, you know, they had domains for the elements. There was a fire domain and an earth domain and a water domain because, well, yeah, if you have a god of the sea, he'd probably have water, the element of water in his portfolio. So it makes sense to have a domain for that. In fifth edition, it doesn't seem to really be that way. Again, the domains really, in my opinion, are just they took basically the wizard spells that clerics don't have access to. And they said, if we were to divide up these wizard spells into 9 groups, what would those groups be? And then that's what they did. And those became the domains so that collectively, if you took all the cleric domains together, you know, they're getting access to a lot of the wizard spells and there's other spells too, like paladin spells and et cetera, et cetera. But I guess my point is that it was much more a mechanical thing and let's divide up the spells in the game than it was any kind of conceptual thing that would make sense in a setting or a pantheon. So it's probably obvious, but I ran into a lot of problems trying to reconcile, you know, the system of domains that is just a mechanical gameplay thing with a pantheon of gods who are characters and trying to make that match up. And my other goal was to try to avoid god sharing domains, because this was something that really bothered me about Forgotten Realms. And my favorite example is, you know, go through all the pantheons in Forgotten Realms, all the different monster pantheons and the different racial pantheons. How many gods are there that have war or combat or battle or something like that in their list of portfolio elements? You know, there's quite a few. You know, the drow have one, the elves have one, the dwarves have one, the humans have a few, I think. And just from kind of a cosmological standpoint, that never really made sense to me. I'm like, there should be one god of war. You know, if the war portfolio is this like mystical, magical thing that exists, it's not just an idea. It's like a pool of energy or an element of creation. How could there be different gods that have dominion over that? And if there were 5 gods that could claim dominion over the war portfolio, you'd think that they would, especially being war gods, would fight it out and be like, there can be only one. You know, I'm not going to share this portfolio with you. Or, you know, another example is wind. Okay. How can there be more than one god of the wind? You know, what if God A wants the wind to blow from east to west, and God B wants the wind blow from west to east? Are they going to fight over it every time? You know, or are they geographically bound? Like they have territories, like God A says, okay, on this side of the mountains, I control the wind. On that side of the mountains, you can control the wind. You know, I'm not saying that you couldn't make it work. And it might even be interesting to have this really complicated, you know, all these different gods fighting over portfolio elements and how they know, you know, who can control the portfolio at a certain time. You know, that could be really interesting, but that's not what I want to do. I wanted something more simple where it's like war, there's the god of war. You know, healing, there's a god of healing. There's not 12 gods of healing, there's one, you know. So these were all kind of ideas or goals that I had trying to come up with my own pantheon. So I was looking at, you know, this list of deities I'd come up with and seeing that I had a lot of gods having the same domains. And I was like, I don't want that. So there's actually a point, I'm sure we'll get to it later in this chapter. We're not going to get to it today. But there's a point where they're talking about creating your own pantheons. And one of the suggestions that they give is a possible way to approach this is just create a god for each domain, which, you know, at the time of making this book, that was 8 domains. And then with a Sword Coast Adventures guide with the Arcana domain, we got up to 9 domains. So it's like you have 9 gods. Each god has one domain. Boom, you're done. The only problem with that is the domains are not a way to conceptualize reality or even a way to conceptualize a certain culture's view of reality, which is what pantheons were in the real world. So take, for instance, the one we're probably the most familiar with, the Greek pantheon from ancient Greece, okay? So if you just look at the various Greek gods and what their portfolios are, what they're the gods of, you can actually infer quite a bit about the Greek culture at that time based on what they had gods of. Well, they had a god of the sea. They had a god of trade. They had a god of wisdom and rulership, you know, and just by looking at the gods that they had, you could start to figure out, okay, they probably did a lot of trade. They had farming, they had hunting, they had kind of a definite naval aspect to their culture. Traveling on the sea was important to them. And all of this just from looking at the portfolios of their gods. So, you know, that's ideally what a pantheon of gods should be. When you look at this pantheon and you look at what the portfolios of the different gods are, they should represent elements of that culture that are important to that culture. So if you have a hunter-gatherer culture, they're going to have a god of the hunt. They're going to have a god of gathering. They're going to have a fertility god. They're probably going to have a fishing god, right? They're going to have gods that oversee elements of reality that are important to that people. On the other hand, if you have another culture that is an agricultural culture and they have large cities, then they're going to have an agricultural deity. They might have gods of law and justice, a god of the court, gods of various political and economic institutions like banks and markets and militaries and things like that. So you can, you know, you could infer a lot or learn a lot about a culture just by looking at who are their gods and what do those gods control. So when you look at the list of 9 domains we have, they really don't fit that super well. You know, we have certain elements that seem to be kind of redundant, like for instance, the nature and tempest domains, which kind of seem like they could be, you know, isn't tempest, you know, storms, isn't that part of nature? You know, so that seems like an instance where we took what could have easily been one domain and we split it up for some arbitrary reason. And then we have other domains that seem to be completely missing. Like, where is the love or fertility domain? Where is the hunting domain? You know, and you could say, well, that could be part of nature. Or where is the agriculture domain, right? Well, that could be part of nature too, but it's like, well, we split tempest off from nature. So why didn't we split hunting off or agriculture off? You know, I mean, to me, nature, I could see hunting being part of the nature domain. Like that makes sense, but agriculture, not so much, because agriculture is more a thing of civilization, right? I mean, fields don't occur in nature. They don't occur naturally. You know, they are products of civilization. You know, they're products of engineering. Fields are created by humans. They don't just happen spontaneously in nature. So I could see a nature domain covering hunting, but not so much covering agriculture or animal husbandry, right? So, you know, again, the domains are much more a mechanical game thing than they are a in-world thing that really interfaces well with portfolios, deities, and pantheons. So a lot of my frustration in trying to come up with a pantheon of deities that really works for Primordia and deciding what domains each deity would have is this disconnect and this fact that the domains aren't a storytelling tool. They're not a way to represent pantheons or deities at all. They're more of a mechanical thing. And this is a realization I've really only recently come to. And I think now that I understand this, and now that I know that the domains aren't a story tool, they're a mechanical tool, I'm no longer going to try to come up with deities that fit the domains or decide what domains are, quote, missing, and then come up with those domains and deities to fit them. Instead, I'm going to do what I should have done in the very beginning, is I'm going to come up with a good pantheon first. I'm going to decide who my gods are, what their portfolios are, what the total pantheon looks like first. And then I'm going to turn to the list of domains in the game, and I'm going to go through each domain and say, okay, the domain of life, do I have a deity that domain just really fits well with? If I don't, I throw the domain out. And I go through all the domains and I do that. And then I look at my gods and any gods that haven't had a domain assigned to them. Then I figure out what I'm going to do. Am I going to maybe take some domain that I threw out because it didn't fit super well and just say, we'll just use that? Or am I going to try to come up with my own homebrew domain that really fits that god? And I think, you know, I think I'll be able to use the domains that we have and make them work as long as I keep in mind that they're just a mechanical thing. They're a game balance thing to give the cleric some non-cleric spells. And they don't necessarily really have to do with the actual god. And that's unfortunate. I think it would have been a much better design if they could do both, if they could be a mechanical thing and a story, you know, thing. And maybe, you know, eventually I'll come up with my own domains from scratch that will be able to do that. But at least right now, you know, I'd like to at least use the 9 domains that we have and not have to completely rebuild the wheel. So, you know, if some of them don't fit the gods super well, I guess I'll just have to live with that for now. So I have my 9 deities I've come up with, but I've realized for quite a while that they're not enough. I'm definitely going to need more than 9. So what I'm doing is I'm looking through some real world pantheons, for instance, the Greek pantheon and others, and looking at who their gods were and what they represented, and use that to kind of build my own pantheon. And then I'll go from there. So kind of almost back to square one with the gods, although I'm going to keep the 9 I've come up with. I just need to come up with probably 10 to 12 more. I think I'm going to shoot for probably, well, I'm going to have as many gods as I need, but I'm predicting it'll probably be around 20. And some of those will be not gods that are so commonly worshipped. You know, and we'll probably get into this more when we start talking about different religious systems later in the DMG. But, you know, in Primordia, I try to have people actually be polytheistic. And so it's really not common for people to have a, quote, patron deity. I mean, that's really something that only makes sense for player characters that are like clerics or paladins. For most people in the world, they honor all the gods, or at least all the gods that are worshipped in their area. So, you know, let's say I have 20 deities. There may be 10 of those that are like the common gods that are prayed to and offerings are made to on a regular basis by most people. And then there'll be, you know, the other 10 are kind of more niche gods, you know, that certain people may venerate, but most people don't, depending on, you know, what the god is and things like that.
This is Shane from the Total Party Thrill Podcast, and you're listening to Lex Starwalker on Game Master's Journey.
I want to give a quick shout out to the patrons of Starwalker Studios. The support of the patrons makes this show possible. If you enjoy Game Master's Journey and you'd like to give a little back, becoming a patron is a great way to do so. Patrons get some cool perks like game material I make for Primordia and access to a special monthly podcast I produce just for the patrons. I'd also like to give a huge shout out and thank you to my tier 4 patron, Mr. Steve Strickland. Let's hear it for Steve.
Yeah.
Yes.
You the man. You the man.
Thank you so much, Steve, and thank you to all the patrons. You can find out more about becoming a patron by clicking on the Patreon button at the top of the show notes at starwalkerstudios.com. All right, so a huge tangent about gods, and that's just one of our core assumptions. So let's get back to our core assumptions here. Next core assumption is much of the world is untamed. Wild regions abound. City-states, confederacies, and kingdoms of various sizes dot the landscape. But beyond their borders, the wild crowd in. People know the area they live in well. They've heard stories of other places from merchants and travelers, but few know what lies beyond the mountains or in the depths of the great forests unless they've been there themselves. So that's core assumption. So, you know, you can either run with this for your world, and in this element, your world will be similar to a lot of D&D worlds, or you could deviate from that in some way. So the deviation we have here in the DMG that you could consider is instead that the world is known. What if the world is completely charted and mapped, right down to the here there be dragons notations? What if great empires cover huge stretches of countryside, with clearly defined borders between them? The five nations of the Eberron setting were once part of a great empire, and magically aided travel between its cities is commonplace. So yeah, that, you know, you could go with the standard, you know, the world is untamed and unknown, or you could flip that on its head and say, no, my world, you know, everything's been mapped, everything's been explored. And, you know, there are these ancient civilizations that are still around. Instead of ancient civilizations that have fallen, they're still running, they're still kicking. So what I did with Primordia is I definitely ran with the much of the world is untamed, but I pulled in some elements from the world as known. So since we're kind of, as we go through this, I'm kind of giving you an overview of Primordia, kind of an introduction to Primordia. There are a few kind of big picture things that make Primordia very different from Earth, which, let's face it, is what most fantasy worlds are based on. So the first thing that's very different is Primordia has two sons, not one, and both of those sons are giants. One is a blue giant and the other is a red giant. So the sky of Primordia is very different than the sky of Earth. Also, Primordia is very close to the center of its galaxy. So even at night, it's rarely truly dark in Primordia because there are many more stars in the sky than what we have on Earth. There are nebulas and galaxies, many more than what we see that are visible in the sky. Primordia also has multiple moons, 8 or 9. I kind of go back and forth on how many moons there are, or one. I might actually just go with one moon because it's like things are already complex enough with two suns and all these galaxies and nebulas in the night sky. I don't know that I need a bunch of moons on top of it, but it might be fun to have a bunch of moons too. So the idea is there's a lot of light in the night sky. There's so many stars. There are, you know, galaxies and nebulas that even like I kind of picture the darkest night on Primordia being like a full moon here on Earth. And when one or more of the moons are full on Primordia, it's like, you know, you can see pretty well at night, actually. So those are some big differences as far as the sky of Primordia. Primordia is also a super Earth. So the planet itself is much larger than Earth. It's huge. So I kind of am using that to kind of turn up the much of the world is untamed aspect, kind of turn that up to 11, because you know, I'm kind of going with the idea of the points of light where, you know, most of the world is wild and savage and untamed and just wilderness. Like there's not people there at all. And then there are these tiny pockets of civilization, these little city states that are settled and, you know, the areas around them are settled. But because the world is so large, the distances between these places are pretty large, usually pretty vast, different distances. And even more than in the ancient world on Earth, you know, the different continents of Primordia might as well be different worlds. I mean, there's not really travel between different continents. You could almost view the different continents of Primordia as completely different campaign settings because they're so far apart that at least in by mundane ways, without using magic, it's not really possible or likely that people will be able to travel from one to another. Now, my seafaring race is the Minotaur, and it may be that the Minotaur can sail from one continent to another, but if they can and if they do, that's something they keep to themselves. It's not a secret they share with others. But the common belief or wisdom is that, people don't even really necessarily know about the other continents other than, you know, maybe mages or whatever. I mean, obviously you could teleport from one continent to another or use magical travel, but you kind of got to know where you're going, right? If you don't even know it's out there, you don't know to go there. So I definitely am doing, you know, much of the world is untamed. However, I pulled in some of the elements of the world as known in that my main kind of campaign setting is the city of Alondria and the region around it. And Alondria has a handful of cities that it trades with, and it has permanent portals that connect it to those cities. So the world of Primordia is so dangerous and the distances are so vast that trade isn't actually done like it is in most D&D worlds. It's not done by caravan or by ship or anything like that. Instead of that, all the trade between the cities is done through magical portals. So Alondria has portals to, say, 5 or 6 other cities that it trades with, and all trade is done through these magical portals. And so, you know, there are the ruins of roads between the cities because long ago, well, actually not that long ago, but years ago, people did travel roads and things like that. But the world has recently become much more dangerous than it used to be. And so those have fallen into disrepair and they're not used. They're not patrolled or anything like that. So, you know, for the most part, it's the world is untamed. There's these tiny pockets of civilization. But I do have a little bit of that world is known spin because, for instance, from Alondria, there are a few cities that you can get to pretty much instantly through a portal. So player characters, for instance, could visit one of these cities and all they got to do is, you know, get the clearance to go through the portal and they're just there. And there's no, you know, there's not going to be random encounters on the way or anything like that. It's literally as easy as stepping through a doorway and they're in this other city. But if or when they leave one of the cities and strike out into the wilds, they're truly on their own. There's not going to be anyone else on the roads. The roads aren't kept up. So once you get very far from the cities, there's may not be much, if anything, left of the roads at all. So you're traveling trackless wilderness a lot of times. There's no one to help you. There's no other travelers. There's no guards that are going to show up at the last moment to save you. You're not going to come on towns or villages very often, if ever. There's kind of these few city states scattered about, and that's kind of it as far as civilization. So once you get, I don't know, half a day's ride or so from a city, you're kind of on your own. And if you can't solve a problem on your own, you're kind of screwed. But you know, that's I like high danger in my RPGs, and I like, you know, the idea that once you leave a city and you go out in the wilds, the players' characters are on their own and they have to rely on their wits and their planning and their magic and their abilities to survive. They can't rely on civilization to help them. And I just dig that. But on the other hand, you know, I could run entire campaigns in cities and they could travel from one city to another and never go out into the wilds at all. So, you know, it just depends what kind of campaign I want to run, which way I would go with that. All right. So our next assumption is the world is ancient. Empires rise and fall, leaving few places that have not been touched by imperial grandeur or decay. War, time, and natural forces eventually claim the mortal world, leaving it rich with places of adventure and mystery. Ancient civilizations and their knowledge survive in legends, magic items, and their ruins. Chaos and evil often follow and empires collapse. And you can see how really all of these assumptions, how they contribute to creating a setting where adventures are very easy to find, right? You know, the fact that the gods are agents in the world, you know, you have possibilities of encountering the agents of hostile gods, of being pulled up into the machinations of various gods. The fact that much of the world is untamed, well, as soon as you leave the comfort of a city or a town, you know, it's very possible to encounter, you know, anything from bandits to monsters to, you know, whatever, you know, and you won't necessarily have a nice detailed map that tells you where everything is and tells you what to expect. You know, you're going into the unknown. And then this, the fact that the world is ancient and pretty much anywhere you go, there was probably at some point in the history, some civilization there, which means there could be ruins or dungeons almost anywhere. There could be lost treasures or magic items almost anywhere. So all of these things make it really easy to have adventures of almost any type, almost anywhere, which is a great design, I think. So, of course, the world is ancient is an assumption, and we could always make a different assumption. So one idea here is the world is new. What if your world is new and the characters are the first of a long line of heroes? The adventurers might be champions of the first great empires, such as the empires of Netheril and Cormanthor in the Forgotten Realms. So there you go. You know, I think most fantasy settings that we're familiar with make this assumption of the world is ancient. You know, I feel like it's definitely true of the Forgotten Realms, seems to be true of Dragonlance, even Dark Sun, Greyhawk. The world of the Elder Scrolls seems like the world is very ancient as well. But you could go a different way with it. And you could say, hey, my world is really new. And this civilization is the first great civilization. Or maybe it's more, you know, like even before that, maybe we don't have something like the Roman Empire yet in this world. Maybe it's a Bronze Age kind of place. So those are ways that you could come up with a world that's very different just by changing that assumption of the world as ancient. Just, you know, keep in mind ramifications of that. You know, I think like I was just saying, a lot of these assumptions make a setting that's very conducive to being able to find adventure easily. And the fact that there are all these ruins to explore where you could find ancient magic items or ancient sleeping demons or gods or whatever. So if your world is brand new, then, you know, you're not going to have all those things. But on the other hand, you know, everything is new. You know, you can still have the world is unexplored going for you. And you just won't so much have ancient ruins, or if any ancient ruins are found, they're going to be super mysterious because, you know, there shouldn't be any ancient ruins. So that would be quite the mystery. So for me with Primordia, Primordia is definitely an ancient place. I really like that aspect. One of my favorite non-D&D settings is the Ninth World of Numenera. And, you know, that's kind of the shtick of that setting is that this world is a billion years old, and literally anywhere you go in the world, at some point in the vast history, there was something there, probably some super advanced civilization. And you could just kind of take a shovel and start digging anywhere. And if you dig deep enough, you'd find something interesting. So I really like that. And I, you know, the Forgotten Realms does that too. You know, there's a lot of ancient empires in the Forgotten Realms. And I like the idea of having epochs throughout the history, which I haven't come up with any of this yet, because it's the kind of world building that I think it's like one of the last things you ever worry about doing. But I like the idea of, oh, well, you know, 100 years ago, there was this civilization. 1,000 years ago, there was that civilization. 5,000 years ago, there was this legendary civilization. And before that, there were numerous civilizations, but they're so far in the past that we don't even remember them anymore. So when the player characters stumble upon a ruin, maybe there's an earthquake and a new ruin is exposed. You know, it could be from any of those. You know, it could be from a civilization that they know something about that was fairly recent, or it could be something so ancient that nothing's known about it whatsoever. And then you get into the fun of strange languages and stuff like that. I just started running the Hidden Shrine of Tamawakan on my YouTube channel, and that's one of the adventures in the Tales from the Yawning Portal book, and it's an adventure from 1980, I think, the original adventure. And it's a very South American-inspired adventure. Mayan, Aztec, Toltec cultures inspire a lot of it. And, you know, one of the things I kind of like about it is there, everything in this facility uses this old language that none of the PCs know. And one of the player characters was fortunate enough to know the spell Comprehend Languages. So when he casts that spell, he can understand speech and writing in that language. But they still haven't figured out a way to actually communicate in the language. They can understand it, but they can't speak it. And it's kind of cool. And it's this at least nod to realism that a lot of times is lacking in D&D, where everybody speaks common. You know, and we completely hand wave the fact that, you know, in the real world, when you went to a new place, you couldn't talk to anybody. And just saying hello and just communicating very basic things like, where can I find food and water, was an ordeal. And, you know, definitely to a degree, you know, that can be unfun in a game. But I think to just completely ignore it is a missed opportunity, and just is ignoring a huge part of what exploration is about, which is, okay, you met these people, but now you got to figure out how to communicate with them and how to find some common ground. And luckily in D&D, there are spells that make that really easy and magic items that make that really easy, but you have to have access to them, you know? And that was one thing I really liked about this particular adventure is, you know, Comprehend Languages is a spell that, you know, anytime I play a wizard, I always learn that spell, as well as tongues, or any class that has access to those spells. I always have them, but I almost never get to use them because, well, everybody speaks common, you know? And so I really appreciated that, at least in this adventure, if a player did know tongues or Comprehend Languages, they would actually get to use it. And it would actually be a pretty big deal. And as luck would have it, one of my players' characters does have Comprehend Languages. And no one has tongues, though, unfortunately. But super cool, you know, because what often is just a useless spell is a very important spell suddenly. All right, our next assumption is conflict shapes the world's history. Powerful individuals strive to make their mark on the world, and factions of like-minded individuals can alter the course of history. Factions include religions led by charismatic prophets, kingdoms ruled by lasting dynasties, and shadowy societies that seek to master long-lost magic. The influence of such factions waxes and wanes as they compete with each other for power. Some seek to preserve the world and usher in a golden age. Others strive toward evil ends, seeking to rule the world with an iron fist. Still others seek goals that range from the practical to the esoteric, such as the accumulation of material wealth or the resurrection of a dead god. Whatever their goals, these factions inevitably collide, creating conflict that can steer the world's fate. All right, so they don't really offer any alternatives to this, and I think for good reason, because Conflict is what makes a good story. Without conflict, you have no story. So I would just say to you, don't design a world without conflict. This is the one assumption that we should all be making, which is that there's conflict everywhere. There are individual characters that are in conflict. There are organizations that are in conflict. There are nations or cities or whatever your world has that are in conflict. There's just conflict upon conflict everywhere, because each conflict is a story, and each conflict is something that the player characters can get involved in and can influence. So yeah, conflict is important for all of us, no matter what our world is. And finally, the last assumption is the world is magical. Practitioners of magic are relatively few in number, but they leave evidence of their craft everywhere. The magic can be as innocuous and commonplace as a potion that heals wounds to something much more rare and impressive, such as a levitating tower or a stone golem guarding the gates of a city. Beyond the realms of civilization are caches of magic items guarded by magic traps, as well as magically constructed dungeons inhabited by monsters created by magic, cursed by magic, or endowed with magical abilities. So there's the assumption, just, you know, not everybody can cast spells, you know, actual spell casters are fairly rare, but there is quite a bit of magic in the world all, you know, put together. Of course, we can do variations on this, and they actually have a few different variants under this, the world is magical. One is the world is a mundane place. So let's turn that dial all the way down to one or even zero. What if magic is rare and dangerous, and even adventurers have limited or no access to it? What if your campaign is set in a version of our own world's history? So I don't think I'd recommend having no magic, because you'd be very, just the player classes and archetypes, you'd be very limited in what you could use, because in 5th edition, so many of them have some kind of interaction with magic. But you could have magic be less commonplace. Maybe, you know, the adventurers in the world are pretty much the only ones using magic, and the only time people see magic is from the PCs. You know, that's a very different world in a very different climate than someplace like the Forgotten Realms, where at least people in large cities kind of see magic all the time and it's no big deal. You know, this could be the kind of world where a PC just uses a cantrip in a village or something, and, you know, people want to hang him or burn him at the stake or whatever. So that'd be very different than, you know, people being unimpressed with the wizard's prestidigitation, because they've seen that kind of thing before. Kind of a similar idea there is monsters are uncommon. What if monsters are rare and terrifying? In the Ravenloft setting, horrific domains are governed by monstrous rulers. The populace lives in perpetual terror of these dark lords and their evil minions, but other monsters rarely trouble people's daily lives. So you could do that. You could throw a big chunk of the monster manual out the window and say, hey, I'm not going to have many or any monsters. I'm going to do something like Game of Thrones. You don't see a lot of monsters in Game of Thrones. There are some notable ones. But for the most part, you know, if you're doing a Game of Thrones kind of game or setting, for the most part, the adversaries of the player's characters would be other humans and elves and dwarves and things like that. So we have this dial of how much magic is in the world. You know, the default assumption is kind of around 5. You know, it's like, well, there's quite a bit of magic, but most people don't see it or have access to it. We talked about turning that dial way down and saying that magic is even more rare. What if we crank that dial up higher, though, to magic is everywhere? What if every town is ruled by a powerful wizard? What if magic item shops are common? The Eberron setting makes the use of magic an everyday occurrence, as magical flying ships and trains carry travelers from one great city to another. So there you go. You know, you could have a setting where magic is everywhere. You know, my first exposure to something like this was in the Dark Elf trilogy, where in the city of Menzo Branzan, you know, you had buildings lit by fairy fire, and drow were levitating and casting globes of darkness left and right. And it was like, every person had some kind of magical ability, at least as far as the drow in the city. And, you know, that was very high fantasy, very different feel compared to anything else I'd experienced at that point, and definitely made an impression. So there we go. We have kind of four core assumptions about a D&D world and what those are, and then some ideas of how you could tweak those one way or another to make your world either slightly different or very different than a place like Dragonlance or the Forgotten Realms. And I think you could see how, you know, you could just take one of these five elements and change it a little, or even change it drastically. And, you know, it would definitely give your world a different spin, give it a different flavor. But if you started changing multiple of these aspects, you know, you could end up with something very different than what a lot of D&D players are used to, depending on, you know, how standard, for lack of a better term, you want your world to be versus how different or unique you want it to be. So as we went through this, I kind of discussed some of my thoughts with Primordia in regards to these aspects. And I think every one of these I've kind of fiddled with a little bit, you know, some of them just slightly and others a bit more. I think the one I didn't really talk a whole lot about is the whole the world is magical. And I think in this one, I'm actually pretty close to the assumption, which is there is a lot of magic out there. There is a lot of ancient magic from ancient civilizations that have come and gone that is out there waiting to be discovered. I have a guild of adventurers that, you know, their members are very magical, whether they're actual spellcasters or they just have a lot of magic items. But at the same time, you know, your average everyday person doesn't use magic. Now, I guess my world is a little bit more magical than the standard because my cities do have these portals. And another thing I haven't mentioned today, but my cities are also protected by these magical force fields, because one of the things that happens in Primordia is more common than you would see in a lot of other D&D worlds. Rifts will open to other planes. And in recent past, a few years ago, for some reason, people don't really understand why, for some reason, these rifts started opening a lot more often. And this went on over a span of a few years. They were just opening all the time. And this led to something that the humans of Alandria called the retreat, which is where humanity had to retreat to a handful of cities that were protected by these ancient magical force fields that somehow kept the rifts from opening within these few just ancient cities that are thousands upon thousands of years old. Nobody even knows how these force fields were created. They can't recreate them. So it's only these handful of cities that have them. And so, you know, humans that weren't able to retreat to those cities, most of them died. Most of the other cities and towns and villages were wiped out by the rifts opening and the things that came through them. So this went on for a couple years where these rifts were just opening all over the place. People were dying left and right, and humanity withdrew to these few protected cities. And at some point, the gods did something to save everybody's bacon. Nobody really knows what the gods did, but everybody agrees that they stepped in and did something. And so now the rifts still open, but they are not opening as often. The frequency of rifts opening is more like what it was before the event, whatever that was that led to this crazy cataclysm of rifts opening left and right all the time. So the gods stepped in, they kind of got things back to the status quo, but some of the rifts that opened during this time are still open. Some of them were stable and stayed open. Some of them collapsed. Some of them, the members of the guild were able to seal themselves. But during this time, a lot of nasty things from outer planes, places like the Abyss, from elemental planes, from the Far Realms, from the Shadow Plane and the Fairy Plane, all kinds of stuff came into Primordia during this time. So even though the rifts aren't opening so often anymore, humanity's still in these few cities that are protected because it's just crazy out there. And in Alandria specifically, they're starting to discuss trying to expand and trying to retake some of the nearby strongholds and protect those and start expanding again, because Alondria is just filled to the gills with refugees and there's not space and food for everybody. But, you know, they're having to take it slow because there's just so much out there to deal with. And the adventurers have a lot on their plate trying to reseal these rifts that are still open, deal with new ones that are still opening, and dealing with everything that's come through. And because the world is so big and because so much of it is unexplored, nobody really knows what came through. And, you know, one of the ideas is that there are powerful entities, and anything from, you know, demons to demon lords to arch devils to unspeakable horrors from the far realms that have come through and have carved out strongholds of power within Primordia and are ruling areas. And as time goes on, they become more and more entrenched. And so it's going to be a long time, if ever, before things are back to the way they were when people could safely travel about from place to place and have villages that would actually survive and things like that. So I think you can see, you know, how you can fiddle with these assumptions and tailor them to what you're excited about. And hopefully, like me, as we went through this, or as you read through this on your own later, just reading through these assumptions and reading through some of the ideas presented in the DMG of ways you could deviate from them starts giving you your own ideas of things that you could do. And what I would recommend doing is what I did. It's just start taking some notes and just write down any ideas you have. And, you know, don't worry about choosing what you're going to do at this point. Just write down all the ideas you have, even if you have contradictory ideas or you have a bunch of different ideas of different ways that you could go. Just get it all down on paper, get it all down in a Word document or whatever, and just record all these great ideas that you have. And then later you can start looking for different ideas that connect together in different ways, in interesting ways, and deciding, you know, which of these ideas you want to explore, which of them maybe not so much. And that's how I got started. And for more on how all that went, you can go check out some of the first of the world building episodes I did way back in the archives. So that will conclude our discussion of the DMG and world building for today. We actually, again, just discussed about a page and a half in the DMG. So not even a page and a half, just a little over a page. So the next time we talk about the DMG, we get into gods of your world and different kinds of pantheons and religious systems. And so I will probably discuss some more of what I'm doing with my gods right now. Maybe by then I'll have even more new ideas that I've been working on here lately. And yeah, we'll discuss the gods of your world next time. Well, that's going to wrap it up for episode 152. If you would like to get a hold of me, please visit the website at starwalkerstudios.com. There you can email me, find my Twitter, Google+, Facebook, Pinterest, YouTube information, and more, as well as the Game Master's Journey voicemail number, where you can leave me a message. If your question or feedback is entertaining or enlightening, or both, you may even hear your message on the show. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future topics, I would love to hear from you. You can also find a link to the Game Master's Journey community where you can share ideas with other listener GMs. Finally, you can learn about how you can support the show by becoming a patron, by making a one-time donation, or by using my Amazon referral link when you shop on Amazon, or by purchasing my new D&D adventure, The Trickster's Labyrinth. You can find all this and more at starwalkerstudios.com. I hope that you have a chance to play your favorite RPG this week. I hope you have a chance to run your favorite RPG this week. I'll be back soon with another episode of Game Master's Journey. Until then, game on.
This has been a Starwalker Studios production. your source for quality gaming and hobby podcasts.
This episode's music, courtesy of Cloudwalker, Transboy, Renfield, Stanko, and Ish. See the show notes for more details at starwalkerstudios.com/gamemastersjourney.